Shaky markets, a weak economy, and signals that don't seem to line up. Hello and a warm welcome to The More You Know, the podcast from Stanlib Asset Management. I'm Jeremy Maggs. And today I'm joined by two members of our multi-asset team, Warren Buhai and Peter van der Ross. And together, we're going to unpack, discuss why equity markets are booming while economic growth seems sluggish and what that means for investors. Gentlemen, a very warm welcome. Warren, sir, let's start with you and a very warm welcome. The all-share index locally is at a record high. GDP, though, is barely above its pre-COVID level. Maybe the starting point for our conversation, make some sense of that disconnect for me.
Sure. So the obvious thing to point out, I guess, is that like most countries, the market doesn't represent the economy. So if you think about the JSE, it's split between only around 45% actually is exposed to the purely to the South African economy, or we call SA Inc. stocks. Then around 30% is resources, of which now is heavily skewed to precious metals. About three quarters of that is precious metals now. And then the remaining quarter is rand hedge stocks, which, as you know, predominated by Naspers and Prosus, which feed off what's happening in China and Tencent, etc. So a lot of our market not driven by what's happening in the local economy. And if you think about what's driven the market to record highs this year, has mostly been that precious metals bull market. So resources sector is up now actually around about 100% for the year to date, which has been the main driver of pushing that market to a new high. And, you know, that's the thing about investments. You can't just look at the economy and think GDP is struggling. We haven't moved much from COVID. We structurally know we're in a low growth environment in South Africa, unemployment is high, etc. The stock market is something completely different. The other thing to point out is obviously the amount of what we call trap money in South Africa. The fact that our pension funds can't invest, you know, all their money globally and have to have, you know, 55% minimum of their money in South Africa means that every month the money coming into pension fund, just a lot of it goes into our market. A lot of the money we manage is obviously pension fund money. The money comes in every month and we're putting it to work in our stock market, as are all our peers in the market. And that permanent flow of capital means that South Africa, especially in local currency terms, tends to be one of the best performing markets in the world. There's been a lot of studies done over many decades, and you will see South Africa tends to always come up in the top two or three markets globally in local currency terms for returns. And we think one of the big drivers of that is the amount of trapped money in South Africa.
So, Peter, let's widen the telescope slightly, and good to have you on the show as well. In the US, the S&P 500 at record highs, but opinion, you'll agree with me, is divided on the health of the American economy. There's a paradox there, isn't there?
Yes, a bit like the real economy in the US. It's a market of two halves. There's the world of the technology stocks, the secular growth stories, which, as we know, have done incredibly well. And then there's the rest of the market. So we sometimes talk about the S&P 493, so the Magnificent Seven being the big seven tech stocks, and then the 493 actually hasn't done all that well. And it speaks to some of that disconnect you're seeing in the real world. It's actually not dissimilar to what we see in the local market. The more domestically oriented stocks here have not done that well relative to the precious metal type stocks. So it's actually a very similar dynamic in that you've got, if you look at the structure of the equity market, there are two very different sides to that market. And one side has done exceptionally well and the other has lagged. Hasn't fallen out of bed, but it's just lagged a bit. So it's understandable that there is some tension. And I suppose it's not dissimilar to Gini coefficient income type distributions. All of these things are somewhat related.
So Warren, this disconnect then between markets and economies, as you've both alluded to, it's something that we're seeing globally. Is it how do investors make sense of that?
I think your previous interview with Morris, he took you through some of our process. And one of our big lenses is liquidity. And we under no illusions that a lot of this market is driven by liquidity. And if we take a step back, what does that really mean? The amount of money that has to go into markets has been huge coming out of COVID. Remember all the stimulus we had, what we would now term with the perfect hindsight excess stimulus for what was needed for the economy. And a lot of that is still sloshing around. We're in this world, what we call fiscally dominated world now, where governments are happy to have large fiscal deficits, despite there being reasonable peace in the world, and really not an unemployment problem. Unemployment in most developed markets is pretty much at all-time lows. So you only tend to get large fiscal deficits during recessions, when governments are trying to help those that are unemployed. But now we've got large fiscal deficits, certainly the largest we've seen outside of war times, going back over 100 years. And that just means a huge amount of liquidity in the world, having to find a place. And in a world, think about it, where there's excess money, where people struggle to believe they're going to get a return above inflation if they go into government bonds. And that means that the money's got to go elsewhere, and that money tends to find its way into many other assets, including equities and precious metals, which, as we say, our market has benefited from this year.
Peter, but the geopolitical risk, though, is on the increase. If you look at the situation in Ukraine, if you look at the Middle East, which is exacerbating, and certainly difficulties and polarization within the United States of America, surely that's going to have a play on this whole deficit argument.
Absolutely. So one of the clear spaces where we see that manifest in equity markets is in the defense sector. So Europe, in the eye of the storm, so to speak, having to expand their fiscal limits, release debt rates, etc., and actually spend their way out of, or rather maybe into a new world where defense is primary. It's one of the sectors we've benefited from being positioned in that European defense sector, and we're probably only at the beginnings of that sort of trend. But yes, what that does is, Warren mentioned fiscal balances. If you look back at the decade between the GFC, so roughly 2009, between that decade from then to COVID, maybe 12 years, that was a world where we struggled to get inflation, despite all our best efforts, monetary policy essentially hitting the zero bound, and the fiscal part of policy was silent. Fiscal has now come alive, and it's very much part of this geopolitical tension where there's very little political will to take difficult decisions. And so far, bond markets are allowing governments to open the fiscal taps. Now, that's, I mean, I say that cautiously because there are some bond markets that are starting to put the brakes on. Mm-hmm. France, a good one of late, Japan, Germany. So these big countries have to be careful about their fiscal spend, but it's coming. It's coming. So that geopolitical stress, it's manifesting right now in something that's good for equities and bad for bonds.
So let's talk about gold very quickly. Where does bullion factor all into all of this, given that equities are still running strong? Is there any kind of correlation between those two factors, Warren?
Yeah, often we see gold...
Is the combination unusual, I think, is what I'm trying to ask.
It is fairly unusual. Yeah. Usually gold is seen as a hedge against geopolitical risk, to your point. So hence why in this period it has done well. That's one of the reasons. The other reason we think there's a few driving gold at the moment, but this issue about fiscal dominance is people start worrying about what's going to happen both with government finances, what's going to happen to interest rates, are they going to be able to afford, you know, to pay back this debt, etc. And then you had the big game changer was, remember, after Russia invaded Ukraine in early 2022, the US started to freeze their assets. And we think that was a big wake-up call, especially for the big emerging markets like China, that they needed to diversify their reserves. A lot of their reserves had been sitting in US treasuries and in dollars. And we thought the longer-term thought process, and we know the Chinese tend to think over decades, looking forward, was that we need to diversify out of these US dollar assets, and especially US dollar bonds. And you've seen that in the flows. They not really selling aggressively, but they've stopped buying US treasuries certainly in recent years. And they've started to buy a lot more gold. And this is across central banks in the world. And this is a diversification out of the dollar. So we talk about this unipolar world that we've been in since the Second World War, where the US dominated, was kind of the world's policeman. And now you can see with Trump's second term, he's trying to pull back from that. So if we move into this more multipolar world, it stands to reason that a lot of these central banks, as I say, especially in the emerging markets away from the West, are thinking about diversifying their assets, and gold is the obvious one that they go to. And we've seen that in the flows data. Huge amounts of gold purchases still going on, kind of unrelated to an equity bull market going on. It's not when you tend to see gold bull markets necessarily at the same time, but these other drivers are clearly massive, and they're multi-decade drivers looking forward.
Peter, how dangerous or concerning is that dollar diversification?
Depends who you are. If you're Donald Trump, it's very dangerous and concerning. Look, it's normal. If you look at through the long arc of history, empires rise and fall. It takes decades, sometimes hundreds of years. Will the US be the preeminent global power 100 years from now? quite possibly not. So these are normal cycles, not to be feared, but adjustment processes can be messy. As long as the adjustment is not too fast or too disorderly, the world will somehow migrate to a new equilibrium. We sometimes talk kind of in market speak, it's speed that kills. A lot like real life. Mm. So it's not so much the adjustment, it's the speed of the adjustment. If it happens too quickly, you have too many imbalances and the system will have to kind of readjust quite quickly. So far, so good. It's an orderly adjustment. And we may not even be at the beginnings of that. We probably are at the beginnings of that adjustment, but it's so far, so good. I think that the main thing, Jeremy, sorry, is that in the world of financial assets, there still isn't anything big enough to clearly take over from the dollar. And I think if there was such a candidate, this adjustment would be swift. But it's not there today.
Warren, let's bring it back to South Africa. The rand and local bonds have delivered strong gains in spite of the heightened geopolitical tension the two of you have alluded to. But why isn't cash more prominent right now? Surely cash should be king.
It's a fair question. I mean, the reality is in an emerging market like South Africa with very high interest rates, cash is not a bad asset in that you're getting around 7 or over 7% now. With inflation around 3.5%, it's a great real return in a very low-risk asset. The problem is a lot of people don't believe reported inflation is what they experience. You know, 3.5% is the reported number, but we know that CPI basket doesn't represent what everyone sees in their daily life.
So what's a more realistic figure?
It depends where you are on the income spectrum. That's the reality. So people having to pay private school, private medical aid, security, etc.
Different picture entirely.
You know, people you speak to every day think their inflation rate's somewhere between 5 and 10%. Mm. And that could be realistic. Mm. So when you compare, you know, cash to that sort of inflation rate in the high single digits, then cash isn't a great asset. And the reality, as you point out, bonds are giving you a double-digit return. Yield certainly at the far end of our bond curve are still double-digit. And in a fiscally dominated world where people are looking for inflation protection ultimately, and this is against monetary inflation. So what that means, they're worried about the purchasing power of money deteriorating, they go for higher risk assets. And ultimately, equities are obviously the highest risk asset, and that's where most of the money seems to be going in now. It won't continue forever, but when you can get returns in equity of 10 to 20% in most markets, it's difficult to justify sitting in cash and waiting for a bear market ultimately.
Just before we end part one of this conversation, Peter, back to you. What about the role of central banks in keeping equity markets elevated despite relatively shaky fundamentals right now?
Central banks are in a very difficult position at the moment because it's not clear, at least in the US and the UK, that the inflation dragon has been slain. Lagarde at the ECB has said that their difficult inflation patch is behind them. Locally, we have a fairly hawkish central bank, always with at least one eye on inflation. So they're in a difficult position, and I wouldn't say they've actually been that supportive of equity markets of late. It differs for the rest of the world. Outside of those geographies, really outside of the US and UK, there's not much inflation. But even there, their real rates have been held up somewhat by the fact that the US's real rates are fairly elevated. So they've not been able to come out and support equities aggressively. They've not been that active with their balance sheets. So they certainly have a lot of tools at their disposal to come in and support equity markets if they need to. And in fact, that probably further bolsters the argument, in addition to the earnings outlook that Warren mentioned, that equities are probably still the place to be.
All right. You're listening to The More You Know from Standard. My guests are Warren Buhai and Peter van der Ross from our multi-asset team. And we're looking at that reality of markets that soar when economies are stalling or at least slowing down, and how investors then should think about risk when the traditional signals don't always appear to add up. So let's continue the conversation. Warren, back to you. Are investors really pricing in future growth, or is it more about liquidity and momentum?
We think liquidity and momentum have been the big drivers, but there's no doubt earnings growth has been good. And then think about what drives earnings growth generally. Revenue tends to be driven by nominal GDP. nominal GDP has been reasonably good globally. A lot of it driven by the stimulus and obviously the high inflation since COVID. So nominal GDP good, revenue therefore good and better than it was pre-COVID. And then you've had big margin expansion. Now, it's debatable whether the margin expansion that we've seen that's fed into very good earnings growth is sustainable. However, we have this massive potential benefit that's just arrived of AI. And margins in many industries are high, especially in the US. It's a bit different in South Africa. But companies, and we see this in South Africa, of the best performing companies, management tends to do a very good job at improving margins, cutting costs to the bone, you know, being able to keep their revenue growing despite cutting those costs. And now the question is, because margins have improved a lot globally, is will they be sustainable? So when we look forward from here, and this is the critical part to us looking into, say, 2026, is what is earnings growth looking like? And actually, it's one of the widest breadth of good earnings growth we've seen in many years. For example, this year, many European countries saw negative earnings growth. They were struggling. But next year, when we look at the forecast, it's pretty much 10 to 15% earnings growth forecast for most of the countries. Now, some of that might come down, but it's promising that looking into next year, the earnings forecasts are good and the revisions have started to stabilize. Normally, you see analysts being too optimistic looking forward and they tend to downgrade their earnings over 6 and 12 months. Now we're starting to see those downgrades slowing, and in many countries, you're starting to see upgrades, which is good looking forward. And as I mentioned, the one positive development is the start of the AI tool rollout and how much benefit that's going to have to both companies' productivity, but for us, more importantly, to their margins. Is it going to help them sustain high margins like they've got to? And that will be the big benefit going into next year as AI rolls out. We think that's a potential upside to margins from here.
I think there's an interesting element to that is that, I mean, Warren mentioned nominal GDP has been good, but I think it's been masked to some extent by that massive post-COVID stimulus in addition to the AI theme. But if you look under the hood a little bit, we know that for the last couple of years, China economically has been through a difficult patch, and they probably still are in the midst of that difficult patch. So has Europe. Europe has struggled post-COVID. So has the UK. And large parts of the US have also struggled. If you look at the massive downward revision last week to US jobs data, so the for the 12 months to March, the total job creation was downgraded by 1 million jobs. And so that tells you, hang on, we've been through a difficult patch globally. And now we see softening interest rates and we see this incredible broad positive earnings outlook for 2026. You go, hang on, equities should be doing well now. We are potentially in a cyclical up phase from here, given this difficult patch we've been through globally, in addition to, as I say, rate support, policy support now.
But Peter, that also makes the assessment of risk that much more difficult when the signals, as you've both said to me, are so much more opaque and even distorted.
So the signals have been distorted by the post-COVID stimulus. A lot of our tools that traditionally gave us reliable signals stopped working for a couple of years. We hope that that post-COVID distortion is now behind us, and we can start relying a little bit more on those tools. Of course, now there's a new development that we're starting to see more and more, and that is the quality of the data, especially from a country like the US. That's been a function of really the hollowing out of the kind of institutional operational capability there. So that's something we need to be a bit more wary of. And of course, if we have a Fed that's more data dependent, but the quality of the data is not what it should be, we need to be careful of navel gazing and kind of hanging on to every word the Fed says, because they themselves are operating, flying a little bit blind here. You know, in a sense, it's probably not a bad thing, because one needs to go back to the traditional view of how do we do this thing? Well, what is the earnings outlook? At the end of the day, stock markets will price the earnings delivery and the quality of those earnings. We've got to go back to those sort of traditional metrics, as opposed to saying, well, what's the second derivative of the or the delta of the data points? Because as you say, they can be misleading, those data points.
Warren, talking about flying blind then, what should long-term investors be most cautious about of when the markets, as you've both said, are fairly buoyant at this point?
think you've got to be cautious of making knee-jerk reactions to the noise that you hear because it's getting louder and louder. Mm. And it ultimately for us goes back to structured process. You need to make sure that you're making decisions based on looking at all the lenses, looking at forward-looking scenarios. And this is what our team spends most of the time on, because if you didn't do that, I think it would either drive you insane or it would make you make too many knee-jerk reactions. The amount of times I'm stopped out in the open when seeing clients or just on the street of people who know me and saying, surely this market's going to collapse 50% at any moment now. Why do they say that? It's because they're on social media and they've got people shouting at them that the market's going to halve at any moment. It's dangerous to react to that noise out in the market and stick to your long-term plan and make sure you know why you invested in risky assets like equities.
Which, Peter, begs the question then, your colleague used the word insanity, mm-hmm. okay? How do you communicate this noise, this complexity to clients who want straightforward answers?
So unfortunately, the answer is probably somewhat cliched. Mm. Clients have to stay invested in financial markets. Yes, there are times, you made the earlier point about cash being king. There are times when cash is king, but only fleeting brief periods. For the bulk of the time, clients need to stay invested in financial markets. And it's our job to worry about the day-to-day minutiae. That's why we get paid, is to worry about these things. And we were professional warriors, really. And I don't mean that in the fighting sense. Yeah. I mean that.
I was going to say professional warriors, not warriors.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that's our job, is to help clients stay the course.
I'm wondering, Warren, if there are historical parallels that maybe would help us make sense of this complex environment right now.
There's many examples in history where it's been as noisy, I would say. The tricky part with today, I think, is the access to information. And that's certainly the difference I see in client behavior compared to when I started in the industry 25 years ago. It used to be when you spoke to clients, you were giving them information that was new to them. Nowadays, there's not much that people don't know because there's so much news out there and so much in their face on social media, etc. So if they want to get noise, they can easily get it. They can also look at their portfolios in real time online, which a lot of clients like to do, which again is dangerous for obvious reasons. But the obvious parallels in history, I guess, for this market would be the late 90s, because you had such a game-changing technology coming in the internet. And if you remember back to those times, there was a fortune amount of investment in internet and fiber, etc., that rolled out in the late 90s, early 2000s. The stock market priced in a lot that wasn't delivered. And then you had the repercussions of that for kind of 10 years afterwards of a lot of those high returns coming back. And now we've clearly got a potential game-changing technology in AR. And the difficult thing for us in the debates we're having every day is how long is it going to take to see kind of in-market returns, which you started to see in returns, but to see it in GDP growth and productivity, a much trickier one to answer, exactly like it was in the late 90s.
So in conclusion then, how do you incorporate all the insights that you've shared with us today into your portfolios? Same question to both of you. Peter, let's start with you.
Warren mentioned a strong reliance on process. It helps us sift through the noise. And the first conclusion, when we look at markets in the world through our different tactical lenses, the first conclusion we've got to draw is now a time to take risk or avoid risk? We think, given the strong and broad earnings outlook globally, it's a time to still lean into risk, take risk. So have a bit more equities than one's neutral or benchmark weightings. And then, of course, the question becomes, well, where's the best place to take risk? As a second order question. And then lastly, well, how do we guard against having the entire portfolio pointing in the same direction? So where do we build in some hedges? Are there some places that are maybe not looking insane? And be a bit tactical about a little bit of sort of tactical hedges, as well as some thematic plays. We mentioned defense earlier, those sorts of things.
Do you want to add to that?
Just add to that in terms of liquidity lens again. It's critical for us to look at what we would call non-traditional market indicators. We think most market practitioners globally tend to focus almost too much on the macro and valuations in the short term. Valuations are very good indicators in the long term, not great in the short term. In an overly financialized world, and what I mean by that is risk asset markets now, equities and bonds, are much bigger than global GDP. You need to be much more on top of things like liquidity, because liquidity is going to be the thing that stops this bull market. And, you know, as long as it keeps going, and central banks and governments are very aware of this, as you saw with how quick their response was to COVID lockdowns, that is the non-traditional market indicator that is a much bigger driver of modern markets than it was historically, and why we're so on top of it at the moment.
Gentlemen, that's where we're going to leave it, and thank you very much indeed. Now, markets and economies don't always march in step, and as we've just heard, the disconnect can create both opportunities and pitfalls. So again, my thanks to Warren Buhai and Peter van der Ross for sharing their perspectives. This is The More You Know from StanLib, where sharper conversations lead to smarter investment decisions. Until next time, goodbye.
StanLib Asset Management Pty Limited is an authorized financial services provider in terms of the FASE Act. This content should not be construed as advice.